for the invitation and the introduction. So my name is Chi Ting Chong, and if you think the name is funny, it's a real name. I'm cheating, always cheating. So today I'm going to talk about like a part of my work on the more theoretical side. So trying to simulate the structure formation in different density environments and the application of this one. And we call this separate universe simulation, and I will tell you the reason why later. So why do we want to even trying to simulate structure formation in different density environments? And the reason is that generally the large-scale structure would depend on the horizon, for example, the matter power spectrum or the halo mass function. And here, the large-scale environment I'm thinking is really large-scale, like 100 megaparsec or 1,000 megaparsec scale. And so this dependence is just coming from real, like general, like normal gravitational evolution, nonlinear evolution. And so usually we use like the observable like power spectrum or halo mass function to constrain cosmology. But if you can have like this dependence, you're trying to measure this dependence in real large scale structure survey, then this dependence carries additional information that you can use to constrain the cosmology further or even to probe new physics. And this is some of the new work that I'll be talking about today. And this is just an example of like how small scale observable depends on the large scale density environment. So in this case, I'm running a super big simulation of 2.4 gigaparsec cube. And I just turn on n-body and then on gravitational evolution turns on and evolve to some final time. And then instead of measuring the whole power spectrum for the whole box, I first divide a box into small volume. And each small volume, I measure the power spectrum. And then I also measure the overdensity of the small volume compared to the entire box. So red means that the power spectrum here is living in the overdense region, and blue means that the power spectrum is living in the underdense region. So I mean, even without doing any fancy statistics, you can see that the amplitude of the matter power spectrum is correlated with its environment. So this means that in the overdense region, you're going to find more structures compared to the underdense region. And I'm starting my initial simulation with Gaussian initial condition. So this evolution, first it will not appear if you have perturbation, it's still Gaussian, but this non-Gaussianity is just purely coming from the gravitational evolution. So this is like sort of things that I want to discuss today. And so particularly I'm going to focus on two observables. The first one is the power spectrum that I just told you. And so let's just try to do this more like a little bit more mathematically. So you can think of like measuring power spectrum in some environment of delta L. And if this dense environment is small, you can just Taylor expand this power spectrum in terms of the environment. So the first order, you get the power spectrum in the background universe without any perturbation. And you get a response. We call this response, how power spectrum respond to the overdensity, and then just the overdensity itself. And once you do this Taylor expansion, you just correlate this guy, power spectrum, with another background density. And now on the right-hand side, you will find that the first term you get zero because this power spectrum is measured in the universe without any overdensity. So the leading order term becomes the second term. So you get an ensemble average of delta L squared. And this thing is basically the variance of the fluctuations, of the mean fluctuations in the volume that you are considering. So if the volume you're thinking is 8 megaparsec, this would be sigma A. But if it's like 100 megaparsec, then this would be sigma 100. So it turns out that this correlation of power spectrum and this environment is equivalent to the bispectrum in the so-called squeeze limit. So the bispectrum, you have three wave number forming a closed triangle because of the translational invariance. And for the squeeze bispectrum, we're particularly looking at one type of the triangle, so squeeze triangle. You have K1 similar to K2, but much larger than K3. And so remember that these are wave numbers, so large wave numbers correspond to small wavelengths. So in this case, you're really correlating two small scale mode with one long wavelength mode. And this is exactly what you're doing here. So that means that this response here, the thing that we are interested in, is equivalent to the information in the squeeze limit bispectrum. And so how, just to give you a more like a illustration on how power spectrum can be modulated by the bispectrum. You can imagine that first you have some long wavelengths, over density, and some under density. And then on top of this, you just put in a small scale fluctuations. And So for the first fluctuation, the blue fluctuations here, I'm thinking there's no correlation between long mole and short mole. That means that the squeeze pi spectrum is zero. And as a result, you see that in overdense region and underdense region, the variance are similar. On the other hand, if you have non-zero squeeze in the pi spectrum, like the red fluctuations here, you can see that in overdense region, the variance will be larger compared to underdense region. So in this case, that means that squeeze pi spectrum is non-zero. In this case, it's particularly positive because you get a positive correlation. And if you go ahead and try to measure this in simulation, this is what you are going to see. In overdense region, you will find more structures compared to underdense region. So this is the sign for the non-zero squeeze mid pi spectrum. So this is the first observable. And the second observable I'm thinking about is the halo mass function. So in other words, just the number of halos for a given halo mass. So you can, again, you can just write down your halo mass function as a function of the environment. And again, I'm doing exactly the same trick. I'm just expanding this halo mass function in terms of the overdensity. And then the next step, I'm going to rewrite the halo mass function in terms of the halo number density perturbation, so delta H here. So this is basically just given by just number of halos in some environment divided by the true mean here. So the true mean means that you're living in a universe without any overdensity. You're really in the cosmic mean at minus one. So you can see that once you rearrange the terms a little bit, you find that on the right-hand side, you get tau halo mass function respond to this environment times delta L. So what we can do here is to define this term, so halo mass function response to the overdensity to be, we call this halo bias. And what this halo bias tells us is that so that means that the halo number density perturbation is biasly tracing the underlying matter perturbation. So if you go ahead, take your halo catalog, measure the halo power spectrum or halo matter cross power spectrum, you're going to get like a bias square times the matter power spectrum, or just the bias times matter power spectrum. And to give you, like, again, just some illustration, so you can imagine you have some density perturbation. So this is matter density perturbation fluctuating at around some mean. And then you put in some threshold and saying that if the density perturbation is high enough, larger than this threshold, a halo will form, a gravitationally bounded object will form. So that means the halo is going to be forming at this like black regions. So this is the case for no long wavelength perturbation. But now if you have long wavelength perturbation, so let me just flip back and forth so you can see that the phase is exactly the same. I'm just changing this mean. And then you put in the same threshold here. You can see that in overdense region, you form more halos compared to underdense region. So in underdense region, to form a halo, you really need the peaks that is already very high so you can pass the threshold. So just, yeah, give you a better sense. I can just flip back and forth so you can see. But now you can imagine that, so this is more like a God's point of view because you know there's a long wavelength perturbation. But if you're thinking like you're a small local observer here, you can only see the universe. This is your observable universe. And what you will see is that you don't feel the existence of the long mole. As long as the long mole has a wavelength large enough. If you don't feel the curvature, you don't see the long mole. But what you will see is that for a guy sitting here, the threshold for forming halo will be lower. So this is like a global point of view, but this is a local point of view. So you don't see any long wavelength perturbation, but the threshold for forming halo depends on the environment. So in underdense region, you increase that means that you need the peak height to be even larger to form halos. But in overdense region, the threshold will be lower. You can see that this two points of view give you the same like a number of halos for this case. So this two, observables, the response of these two observables are the main topic that I want to discuss today. And so how do we even study this response, right? So the most straightforward way is to just run like big simulation as I show you in the second slide. And then you're just trying to divide this big simulation into different environment, overdense or underdense regions. And then you just see how observable are correlated with their environment. Sure, you can do that, but this is going to be very expensive if you want to run a very big simulation, because you need a large amount of you need a large number of particles to achieve certain mass resolution for your halos. So alternatively, what we are trying to do here is that we are trying to absorb the long wavelength overdensity, the environment, into a change of cosmological parameters. So just like the local guy's point of view, if you're living in an overdense region, you don't know you're living in an overdense region. But what you will feel is that the cosmological parameters are going to be different if you measure locally. So this is, so we call this separate universe approach. And I will explain in detail how the mapping between the overdensity and the change of cosmological parameters later. And if we know this mapping between overdensity and the change of cosmological parameters, then we can directly perform n-body simulations in different density environment. So if we know the mapping, I can directly simulate a small overdense universe or a small underdense universe instead of running a big one and then trying to locate overdense and underdense universes. And you can see that because you're only running a small simulations, the computational cost will be much cheaper to study this dependence. And another advantage of running the separate universe simulation is that this is the exact setting for testing. Because when you run a separate universe simulation, you're thinking that the overdensity is like a uniform overdensity. So this wavelength is really, as a local point of view, is really infinitely long. So this is the exact setting to test this response, which does not exist if you're running a big simulation, because the wavelengths you're having there is finite. And also,
that setup doesn't exist in real universe either. So,
I'm sorry.
The setup of an exact uniform background doesn't exist in universe.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to say here is that if you look at the response here, so in real universe, this guy can be stochastic, because right. You have all kinds of mode. But this response would be the same. Yeah. So we're just trying, because this one can be just calculated from power spectrum. If you correlate this guy with another delta L. But this one, you can characterize by the response. And yeah, the final advantage of the separate universe simulation is that if you set up the initial condition cleverly, then a large part of the cosmic variance can be canceled. And I will also explain this a little bit later, but let me first just show you how separate universe works. So you can imagine that at some early time, you have some small universe. So I cannot draw this infinitely small, but you should just imagine this is like a tiny universe at some early time. And let's assume this is the background universe without any overdensity. And then at some later time, universe expands. So this would just, from the black universe, this is going to expand to this blue universe. So this is the case if you have just the background density. Now if you're trying to put a little bit overdensity inside, in this black universe. But so here the assumption is that at some early time, all the perturbations are infinite, are all extremely small. So the black, so even if you put in some overdensity inside, they're also coming from this black universe. But at some later time, it's only going to expand to this red universe because their overdensity produce extra gravity, slows down the expansion. So at the same physical time, the background universe expand to this red sphere, but overdense one only expand to this blue, the red sphere. So what you can do right now is that just because both these two blue and red universes are coming from the black universe, you just use the conservation of total matter. And this then directly gives you a relation between two scale factor observed by the local observer. So it's to the leading order is given by here. So I'm going to denote the quantity in the overdense universe with a small tilde here. And you can see that if this delta L is positive, then A tilde would be smaller compared to the background universe, which makes sense because overdense universe will expand slower. But more important thing here is that because of the presence of this guy here, the long wavelength perturbation, that means that if you're trying to calculate the Hubble expansion or the acceleration equation for this universe, they're going to be affected by the presence of this delta L. So as a local observer, again, if you're living in this region, you don't know you're living in overdense region, you go ahead and trying to measure a set of cosmological parameters that can describe the expansion history for this red universe. You find that you are going to find a different set of cosmological parameters compared to the blue universe. So that's the basic idea of the separate universe approach. And I don't want to go into detail for how to calculate the corresponding cosmological parameters. It's a fairly straightforward calculation. But I just want to just show you the result. So if you consider the background universe to be flat lambda CDM without curvature, it turns out that in the presence of the lone mole, the curvature becomes non-zero. So here delta H is given by here. And so more specifically, if you're living in an overdense region, the curvature will be positive. And if you're living in an underdense region, the curvature will be negative. And so one intuitive way to think about this is that if you're living in an overdense region, you know that this region is going to collapse in the future. And this is exactly the same behavior as if you have a positive curvature. And vice versa, if you're having an underdense region, this is going to expand in the infinite size in the future. And this is just like a negative curvature universe. And this, again, this is not a new idea. I think it's already, maybe, I don't know, in Peebles' book, but I'm sure it's in Weiber's book. Yeah. So again, the real important thing is that if you know the mapping between this delta L and the cosmological parameters, then you can directly simulate an overdense or underdense universe. So this is just the illustration. You can imagine that this is the box we're trying to simulate. And we're having some initial conditions for the density perturbation. And then we're going to put in the lone mole. The lone mole being the underdense region, underdense mole, or overdense mole, or the mean mole. And you can just visualize this as all these different perturbations, lone perturbations, are going to give you different cosmological parameters. So we don't even need to touch the n-body code. We just need to modify the parameter file. And then we're going to use exactly the same face for this box. So that's what I mean by set up the initial condition cleverly. And the reason is that, for example, if we're looking at halo formation, we know that in overdense region, the halo is going to be a little bit more massive compared to underdense regions. But if you use exactly the same phase, what you're having is that you know there's going to be a halo here. You only change the halo mass a little bit. So if you use the same initial condition, that gives you a very precise characterization of the response. And then I'm going to define the response for some observable A to be the one measure in the overdense universe minus the underdense universe and divided by the mean. So first, let me show you the result for the power spectrum response. So here is the scale of the small scale power spectrum that I'm measuring. And the red line here is showing the separate universe result. So you can see this one. And so you see this wiggles. And this wiggles are really the BALs of the three-point function, because this one is the response. And the power spectrum response is equivalent to the Squid-Smith bispectrum. And so that means that what we can do is to compare this power spectrum response to a gigantic simulation. And we try to measure power bispectrum, Squid-Smith bispectrum inside, and see whether they agree. So this one is actually coming for the big simulation is really the blue line here. So this one is actually the same simulation that I show in the second slide, a 2.4 gigaparsec cube. I just divide this power spectrum, measure the correlation of power spectrum and the background density, and then I just average them over all 160 simulations. You can see that they basically agree. There are some small differences. We think it's probably due to the small different box size. There's some window function here for this measurement. But generally, you can see that this agrees pretty well.
What happens at large k? It seems that they diverge from each other at large k.
Oh, so I think they have different mass resolutions. So on very large scale, on very small scale, then I won't trust this guy too much because the mass resolution for this simulation is pretty low. And that's another advantage of running separate universe simulation, because you can achieve higher resolution. It's only limited by some like astrophysics effect if you're running in body. So this one is for matter power spectrum, and now I'm going into halos. And for halos, for in body simulation, you first
Is it possible to just compare that to an analytical prediction?
I'm sorry.
Is it possible to compare that to an analytical prediction?
Yeah, I do have the analytical prediction, but I think they would only work like at this region because. Because on small scale, so analytical prediction is still coming from the perturbation theory approach. And then we know that perturbation theory is going to break at some like a large small scale k here. So yeah, we can discuss later. We do have, in this paper, we do have the perturbation theory or halo model or other like emulator that you can just compute a power spectrum. But you will see the agreements happen like especially here. But on a small scale, the analytical work is not going to agree very well. So we run the n-body simulation for matter perturbation, and to compute the mass function, you need to identify halos. And the usual algorithm for finding halos is that you need to pass some threshold or some, if you use friends of friends, you use some linking length. But one important thing here is that if you're, as I said in previously, if you're living in an overdense region, you have to lower your threshold, or if you're living in an underdense region, you have to increase your threshold. So this has to be accounted. To get the precise measurement on the halo mass function. So we account for this, and then I'm going to define the, we call this response bias because it's a derivative of halo mass function from the separate universe simulation. So this is one way that we can measure bias. And another way we can measure bias is we call this clustering bias. We just go to, we don't need a separate universe simulation. We just need a background simulation. We measure the halo matter cross spectrum and divide it by the matter-matter power spectrum. And we define this bias here. And hopefully these two would agree. And so this is the result. So this is not my work. This is from like other people. There are many lines here, but they are just corresponding to different bias prediction for different models. I only want to highlight the red crosses here and the blue and the green points. The red crosses is coming from the clustering bias. So you really measure halo matter power spectrum and divide it by matter-matter power spectrum. And the green points are the separate universe simulation, so the response in the halo mass function. And you can see that across like two decades in halo mass, the agreement is actually pretty good. And especially the separate universe simulation gives you really tiny error compared to the correlation measurement. So this just gives you another way that you can characterize the halo bias. Okay, so far I've been talking about the separate universe simulations in lambda CDM universe. And the question is, what if we have like a neutrino, or just generally, what if we have another fluid? So the case for the lambda CDM is that as long as the mode you're thinking is above some like maybe 100 megaparsec, above some scale, all the modes are going to evolve linearly, and their evolution is exactly the same because they are all linear modes. As a result, it doesn't matter what mode you're putting in, right? If you have a small box, you're putting in a 1 gigaparsec cube, 10 gigaparsec cube long mode, they're going to change the separate universe in exactly the same way because 1 gigaparsec cube mode and 10 gigaparsec cube mode, they're evolving in the same way. But the story becomes different if you have massive neutrino because we know neutrino has a large thermal motions. And so they have a free streaming scale. So on very large scale, the neutrino perturbation would behave like CDM. They cluster together. And on small scale, neutrino perturbation don't grow. Only CDM grows. And as a result, the CDM perturbation is going to be scale dependent. And then when you think about separate universe and you put in the long mode, then if your long mode is scale dependent, that means that the response is going to depend on what's the wavelength you're putting in your separate universe simulation. So that's, yeah, the basic idea. Just to give you an idea of how different long wavelength perturbation are evolving, so we use CLAS, the Boltzmann code, to calculate just the transfer function or just the density perturbation, CDM density perturbation. So these are the cosmological parameters. And so n nu is just the number of neutrino. So I know number of neutrino is 3, but I will explain why it's 28 later. And then m nu is the neutrino individual neutrino mass. We assume they're all the same. And f nu is just the fractional contribution of neutrino to the total matter. So it's just omega nu divided by just total matter, CB plus omega nu. And different lines are just showing different wavelengths. So you can see that this is the longest wavelength we have. So as I just said, if you're going to very large scale neutrino cluster with CDM, the perturbation, that means that the growth of the CDM perturbation is stronger. So if you normalize everything to be the same at the final redshift, they're going to be smaller at the initial redshift. On the other hand, if you're going to a smaller scale perturbation, only CDM grows, so the perturbation grows slowly, As a result, at the initial time, the perturbation is larger. But the really important thing here is that the different responses is really coming from different evolution of these long mode. So how is the separate universe affected by the long mode? So let's first consider the case where the long mode has wavelengths much larger than free streaming scale. And in this case, if you initially have some CDM overdensity, and assuming that the perturbations are adiabatic, you also have some neutrino density, and they are going to grow coherently because the mode you're thinking is very large scale. So as a function of time, this overdensity is going to collapse in the future. They're collapsing together. So this is the case if you're thinking about a mode larger, much larger than the free streaming scale. On the other hand, and one more thing I want to say here is that because they grow coherently, so you cannot really distinguish neutrino from CDM. So in this case, the separate universe will just be the same as lambda CDM. So overdensity is just still like a curvature. But in the second case, the mode you're thinking is that smaller than the neutrino free streaming scale. So in this case, we know that neutrino will stay smooth outside, but CDM will grow. So now you're imagining that you're a local observer here inside this black universe. What you will see is that as a function of time, the black universe will collapse, but neutrino stays outside. So if you have the ability to count the total number of neutrino particles, you will feel that you're losing neutrino outside. Neutrino are streaming out. And it turns out that you can still try to construct a separate universe in this case, but you need a fake energy density. Basically the entropy perturbation that accounts for the loss of neutrinos seen by a local observer inside this universe. So it becomes like non-trivial to define a set of cosmological parameters in this case, but in terms of running separate universe simulation, it doesn't really matter because the assumption is that the separate universe is defined by the conservation of CDM particle. And as long as the total CDM is conserved, we can always use this equation here to define your Hubble. And the Hubble expansion is the only thing that we need in n-body code. So what we do here is that instead of changing the parameter files, we really need to just modify the n-body code. So instead of computing the Hubble expansion using the cosmological parameters, we just first pre-computed Hubble as a function of redshift, so as a table, and then we just interpolate Hubble when we need the Hubble in different separate universe simulation. So this will be the setting for the separate universe simulation with neutrino. So this is a box I'm going to simulate with CDM particles inside, and I'm going to put two long modes here. And now you can see that this is the free streaming scale. So these two long modes, because this guy is above the free streaming scale, the growth will be stronger. And this guy is below the free streaming scale, growth is weaker. And different evolution will give you different responses. In particular, this long mode here, the blue mode, because they are above the free streaming scale, neutrino behaves like a CDM. You cannot tell, you cannot distinguish them. So perturbation of this one, behaves just like curvature. So I guess there's really not a big problem here. The question is this guy here, because only CDM cluster, you need to introduce some entropy perturbation to account for the loss of neutrino. So you might think this this separate universe for this guy is a little bit fishy here. But in the next slide, I'm going to justify that this assumption is still a good, calculation of Hubble is still a good assumption to run separate universe simulation, even if you're under the free streaming scale.
Did you already show the mapping from delta L to mu? The mapping from delta L to mu?
Delta L and mu are not related.
So how exactly for given neutrino mass are you changing the background expansion?
I'm not sure I'm following your question.
You're saying that you're not actually modeling neutrino physics inside the simulation.
But right, they're only the background. Yeah.
So how do you map the neutrino mass?
So what we did here is really this one.
Neutrino mass sets the free streaming scale.
Yeah. So neutrino mass would determine the free streaming scale here. But I guess your question is how do we get this delta L, right? It's really just coming from class. So given a set of cosmological parameters with neutrino mass, I can always compute just the evolution of some long mode for different KL. So we just pre-compute this with CAM, and then once we have this, we can just calculate Hubble, and then we can run mBody. So another feature, one last thing I want to point out in this slide is that you see that the box I'm drawing is smaller than the free streaming scale. That means that neutrino doesn't cluster inside. And the reason for that is that we don't want to run neutrino particle simulation, because if you're thinking about the box larger than the free streaming scale, you also need to worry about the neutrino clustering. So what we did here is really just simulating n bodies, just the CDM particles in this box, and then model the neutrino on the background. Okay, and right. But before moving on to neutrino, let me first justify like the separate universe for this guy, because you need we call fake separate universe. And for this check, we didn't go for neutrino because it's not easy to simulate neutrino. But what we did is for the quintessence, dynamic dark energy. And the reason we're doing dynamic dark energy, so the idea is the same. So dark energy might have some perturbation. They will cluster with CDM above their gene scale, and they're going to be smooth under their gene scale. So this is the idea is exactly the same as neutrino. And the reason we're going for dark energy is because it's really easy to simulate a smooth dark energy, because they are just like lambda with a different equation of state. So this is what we did for the dark energy. So this blue line here shows the power spectrum response for if you have density perturbation larger than the dark energy free streaming large dark energy gene length, and this is below the dark energy gene length. So these black red line and blue line are coming from the separate universe simulations, and the green line here is coming from simulating a really big box of simulation and assume dark energy is smooth. So you can see that, so this one, because dark energy's perturbation are just, and CDM perturbation grow together, they are just going to be curvature. So separate universe for this one is probably not a big problem. But the Fisher one here, you can see that they still agree pretty well with the real, like a smooth dark energy universe simulation. So this is for the bispectrum, and we also check for the halo mass function, the halo bias. So you can see that, another thing I forgot to say that you can see, the response already depends on the mode, the wavelengths you are putting in. So that means that the bispectrum depends on, becomes scale dependent. So it depends on the long mode that you are putting in. And the same is true for halo bias. So you have super gene small, sub gene small, and the clustering bias is also only measured in the background, the smooth dark energy background. So you also expect this clustering bias agrees with only the sub gene's response. And you can see that across, again, two decades in halo mass. It's a little bit noisy, but you can see that it generally agrees with the subgenes horizon. So this just want to convince you that the fake separate universe simulation still works. Yeah?
Just a quick clarification. So,
yep.
So you're doing both super and subgene scale, so that means that you're modeling the clustering of this dynamical fluid in perturbation theory and just sticking that in there?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we only do like extreme supergenes and extreme subgenes because they are easy to do.
So you're not modeling the clustering, you don't assume it's completely as smooth. But,
the clustering will be included in this one, right? Because the long mode has the clustering, dark energy clustering effect inside. And the reason we didn't run for like a big simulation dark energy clustering is because that's difficult. That requires a.
I'm confused by this one. So subgenes is your box is bigger than the gene scale, or?
Box is always smaller than the gene scale.
The box is always smaller.
Yeah.
So this one is subgenes and this one is supergene scale.
Yeah. So subgenes and supergenes is the long mode. So this one will be supergenes and this one will be subgenes. Yeah.
Oh, but both are still always very much bigger than the box.
Yeah, so that's the assumption. Otherwise, you need to worry about the curvature of this long mode. Yeah. Yeah, that's the assumption. But yeah, there's something that is violated in our neutrino separate universe simulation, but I will try to justify later. Right, but this one just show you the validation for separate universe. And now let's just move on to the massive neutrino. So as I said, in our separate universe simulation, we always just simulate CDM, the dynamics of CDM. So we don't simulate neutrino particle. And so to make this assumption good, we need to set our free streaming scale large enough. And the way to achieve that is to set the relatively small neutrino mass. So we just go for 0.05. So then the free streaming scale is around 200 megaparsec. So you, for like halo formation or for, because largest halo you're having is, has Lagrangian radius of 10 megaparsec. So you probably don't need to worry about that. And right, so we just fix mu to be 0.05. And then now you can see that if you still, if you have only standard three neutrino, then F nu is going to be only 1%. And you then to find a 1% effect, you will need a large amount of simulation to pin this effect down. And to conquer this, we just need to make a number of neutrino large. So we just artificially increase the number of neutrino to be 14 or 28. And this leads to F nu of 5% and 10%. And for the effect that we're thinking, because even 10% of F nu is still enough, right? So if you have two data points in terms of F nu, you can kind of extrapolate down to a more realistic number of F nu. And then for the long mode, we're choosing delta L of like a point plus minus 0.01, and for five different wavelengths. And these long modes are solved by the Boltzmann code. And here is the power spectrum response. So again, there are two scales here. So first scale here, I'm plotting on the x-axis, is the scale of the small scale power spectrum. And the second scale is the long mode that I'm putting in. So it's in this or in this direction. So you can see that, so first important thing here is that they are, depending on what mode you're putting in, the response is different. And this will not exist in lambda CDM universe because they all evolve in exactly the same way. So putting 1 gigaparsec cube, 10 gigaparsec, they're all, the response is going to be the same. And right, so when I talk about, so the power spectrum response is equivalent to the squeeze limit bispectrum. So when I talk about like a scale dependent bias, it's not really the scale dependence on this axis. I mean, even in lambda CDM case, you have k dependence on the small scale because of nonlinear evolution. But what's more interesting here is the dependence on this long mode that you're putting in. So what we can do here to examine this a little bit better is that I'm going to fix the small scale mode and plot this as a function of the long mode. So you can see that this is the result. So these blue points are from the simulations. And I'm normalizing everything here to be one. So I'm just trying to see how large is the effect. And you can see that for the effect on the and the bispectrum, the effect is around 6%. But know that our F nu is 10%, so you can kind of parameterize this as 0.6 times F nu for the total effect. And the red line here just shows you that the response from the linear growth. And the reason is that we're calculating this is because the power spectrum is proportional to linear growth square, to the leading order, if you're thinking about linear power spectrum. Then, so although the scale that we are plotting here is pretty nonlinear, this scale dependence can still be captured pretty well by the how linear growth respond to the long wavelengths over density. So this just shows you that we're not doing something crazy. This still agrees with the perturbation theory calculation. And we can also examine this for as a function of number of neutrino or just number of just the F nu. So we have two data points, F nu of 10% and 5%. And you can see again that if you're just trying to solve the slope and the intercept, it's 0.6 times F nu. So yeah, it's small for realistic neutrino F nu. But it's still not negligible in terms of F nu. So yeah.
So this is for your separate universe simulation?
Yeah, these two data points are coming from
simulation. The previous ones you were showing as well, right? All the last couple of slides are also from the separate.
This one is also from simulation. The data points are from simulation.
I guess I'm a bit confused because I thought you only can do these two regimes that either vary supergenes or subgenes.
That's the case for dark energy. But for massive neutrino, we can solve, because all these long modes for the given KL, we can solve them directly. So in other words, if you go back to this guy here, so you have some free streaming scale. Yeah. What you can do is just something, if some modes have like roughly the same size as free streaming scale, it's not exactly subgenes or exactly supergenes, but you can still solve them using class. the important thing, yeah.
This is linear theory, right?
So, yeah,
but
yeah.
Then, so to do the simulation, I guess I'm just trying to see, so you're not actually running simulation with neutrinos?
No.
You're not running it, are you doing it with dynamical dark energy or?
But that's separated. Dark energy is, dynamic dark energy is separated from neutrino. Yeah, so let's just stick with neutrino here. So what we're doing here is that we are simulating n-body CDM particles inside this box, but the box has to be smaller than the free streaming scale.
That's right.
Right, because we don't simulate neutrino particle inside. On the other hand, the long mode you put in for this box can have different wavelengths dependent. And these long modes, if you assume they are linear on large enough scale, then you can use class to solve.
The class gives you the linear evolution of the right, it's a linear code, right? So class
yeah.
Gives you linear evolution.
Yeah.
So you use that and then...
Right, so So we first solve this delta L, linear delta L, and then we put it into Hubble. And then for this, so for different wavelengths, you can imagine you have different Hubble, yeah. And then different Hubble, you have different response, yeah.
More question, like,
yeah.
So I missed what the red curve was in those plots. You might have seen.
Which one?
So.
This one.
Yeah. Is that some growth function d? What is?
Oh yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. This is the linear growth. So this is the power spectrum response, and because power spectrum is basically proportional to linear growth, right? So what we are doing here is that you just consider how linear growth would respond to a long wavelength perturbation. So you can see that it agrees pretty well with the n-body simulation, even if these data points are non-linear. Yep.
There's something similar happened to the Hilbert.
I'm sorry?
There's something similar happened to the Hilbert.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So that's where I'm going to, yeah. So yeah, this is the halo bias. And right, so here I'm showing, so different symbols are for halos for different masses. And this is the ratio of the Lagrangian bias. So all these guys have different halo bias, but I'm going to normalize everything here to be one, and then just show the size of the effect that we're looking for. And you can see the first interesting thing is that the effect in terms of Lagrangian bias has pretty weak mass dependent. It doesn't really depend on what halo mass you're thinking. They are all having a very similar step size or scale dependence. But this is going to be violated if you evolve this in Eulerian bias, because they all have different Lagrangian bias in the beginning. And right, and a second thing is that you can question whether this is correct or not. So what we're trying to justify here is that maybe you can do some easy spherical collapse calculation. For example, so what we do here, this a black dashed line, is the spherical collapse calculation, and then you just put in the long mode. So this is the separate, just usual spherical collapse calculation in the environment of a long mode. And you can see that they actually agrees pretty well with the, there are some difference, but it captures the scale dependence pretty well. And the magenta line here is a similar model, but what we are assuming here is that the halo mass function is universal. So the halo mass function is just proportional to the underlying matter power spectrum. And then so halo mass function response must be similar to the matter power spectrum response. And matter power spectrum response is given by the growth response. So you just need the growth response to calculate this magenta dot dash line. And they also, yeah.
Sorry, when you say spherical collapse in the presence
yeah.
of the long mode, you mean you stick in the Hubble that you've assumed for
yeah.
the background
yeah.
in a simulation in the presence of the long mode, and then
yeah.
in that background you do this.
That's right. But but for that you don't need to run simulation. It's kind of just linear calculation. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So right. So this is a new first effect being detected from a simulation, because. This has been predicted before by Marilena Laverty, but no one has really seen this in the simulation. And I think there's two reasons for this. So first reason is that because people usually don't want to touch the number of neutrinos, right? Because we have a pretty good idea it's 3. Making it 28 sounds is horrible. And if you fix neutrino mass to be 3, and for a small like neutrino mass, then the effect is only a total amount of F nu is only 1%. It's just hard to pin down 1% effect. So for this simulation, so this is, I think this is 100 neutrino simulations run by the Francisco in CCA. So he has, I think this is like the one of the best suite of neutrino simulation they have. So this box size is 1 gigaparsec cube, and number of particles I think is 1024 cube for both CDM and neutrinos. So even if you have such big simulation, I'm just measuring bias, you can see that it's still hard to achieve like a percent measurement on the halo bias. And especially if you're looking at like a percent difference here, I will tell you the difference here. So I think that's one reason that we haven't seen this in neutrino particle simulation. And the second reason is that the effect that we are predicting is on really large scale. So you can see that this is 10 to minus 2, and this is 10 to minus 3. And these two lines, so red line is the usual scale independent bias, just some B1. And because of nonlinear clustering, you can see that this bias goes up very crazy quickly. So I need to include a K-square to account for the nonlinear clustering. So this one is basically the usual scale independent bias prediction. And this one, the BL1 tilde L, this is our prediction for the scale dependent bias. And for the, we also need to include a K-square here. So you can see that these two lines, so scale independent and scale dependent linear bias, they only differ on really large scale. And for this difference here that we're looking at is, I think it's 0.6%. Because it's like, 0.6 times F nu. And F nu for this case is around 1%. So that means that you just need a big simulation and large number of simulations so we can pin down this effect. So I'm working with this guy right now to just trying to run. So this is 1 gigaparsec cube, and this is the fundamental mode you can get. And we're just trying to run a 2 gigaparsec cube and trying to maybe add one more data points here, because you can see the difference is larger on larger scale. So if we have one more data point, and then if we have like enough statistics, then maybe we have a chance to really like validate or falsify our prediction.
This is a minor point, but what's the size of these errors in the simulation?
Are you thinking they're too small or too large? Or?
I'm just curious, is that like the stochastic part of bias?
So on large enough scale, I think, and this one is coming from just measuring matter, halo matter divided by matter. Yeah.
Just the sample area, it cancels in that ratio, so it's...
Yeah, but I think, yeah, so we were just talking, you still have a number of k-modes in the denominator. Yeah, I wrote down the just S-mater for just PHM divided by PMM, and the uncertainty for that, for this estimator, you still have like, I think it's P shot divided by number of modes. So you still have shot noise and number of modes. So this, I guess, yeah, you have just limited modes here. Yeah.
How big is the box?
For this one, it's 1 gigaparsec cube.
Right, but I guess the point is that you don't have to calculate PHM and PMM, you calculate the deltas and look at the ratio of the lower densities rather than the Fourier modes rather than the power.
In principle you can do that, but I think, Mari has shown that the optimal estimator for measuring bias is that you just sum over for each K beam, you just do halo matter and divide it by matter. That gives you basically the same as delta H of K as a function, as a direction of K, divided by underlying delta C of K.
Yeah.
Right, so this is like the one of the new effects that we're predicting and trying to convince people that it's there. Although it's observationally, I think it's not relevant at this moment, but I don't know, maybe in the future this is going to be important, especially if you're looking at some number times F nu effect, then you can argue that 0.6 times F nu is not that small. Right? And so in the final part, I just want to give you some more like application for the separate universe simulation that we can do. And especially for one thing that I'm very interested in is to construct different Squeezimid bispectrum model. And so you can imagine that Squeezimid bispectrum always has two modes, one long mode and two small modes. If the long mode of interest is like, let's say greater than a few hundred megaparsecs, so it's linear, then we don't need to even run simulation to get the long mode, because they are just coming from linear theory. But for the short mode, we know they must come from simulation, right? Because the nonlinear evolution. Also, the response also comes from simulation. So what we can do here is to just run separate universe simulations to see how short mode, small scale power spectrum evolve and respond to the long mode. And this becomes a really good ansatz for building the squeeze mid bispectral model, like formed by different observable. So in this paper with Anjay, we are just interested in maybe just you're thinking about cross-correlating the Lamm-alpha forced with the CMB lensing convergence. So you can imagine that you have many sine layers of forest measurement, and some of them might be living in overdense region, some of them might be living in underdense region, and you can just correlate with their lensing, CMB lensing convergence, and the lensing should tell you whether it's in overdense region or underdense region. So we went ahead and just, so you can imagine that this bispectrum formed by two small-scale flux fluctuation and one long wavelength lensing convergence can be just schematically written down by how power spectrum respond to the underlying matter perturbation and the correlation between this delta and the lensing convergence. And this is linear, right? As long as the KL is large enough. So this requires only one integral for the lensing convergence. But for this guy, we need to run simulation. And for Lamm-alpha forest, especially, we need to run hydro simulation. So we run the hydrodynamic separate universe simulation for this guy, and then we just multiply by this guy. And this gives you a prediction for this specific bispectrum. So we compare our calculation with the measurement. So these guy here, what they do is really to take the Boss Lamm-alpha forest sine lines and correlate with CMB, the Planck lensing convergence. So these are their measurements. So as a function of the small scale, like the scale for the Lamm-alpha forest power spectrum. And the blue line here, the blue dashed line here is our prediction for the separate universe. It's really just this piece here. But to interpret, it turns out that to interpret this signal, there's one important systematics for the Lamm-alpha force fluctuation measurement. Is that so? For some quasar spectrum, you have some absorption, and you try to fit out the continuum to get the fluctuation. But it turns out that the mean absorption of the flux and the quasar brightness is completely degenerate because they are just a constant for each sideline. So it turns out that if you measure the Lamm-alpha forest power spectrum and the lensing convergence, you will pick up some signal because you use the wrong reference mean to compute your density perturbation. And it turns out that this effect is not small. So this will be the purely like gravitational contribution, and this red line is coming from the systematics that you're missing in the Lamm-alpha forest measurement. And if you compare add these two together and compare with the measurement, you see that the agreement becomes good, better. So in terms of chi-square, okay, so in terms of the plot, it looks really bad. The fit looks really bad. But in terms of chi-square, it's not that bad. It's because all these data points are highly correlated. And you can also tell this by seeing that they're not really scattering around. So they have the measurement of the full covariance matrix. And these chi-square are computed from their covariance matrix. And you can argue that, right? So degrees of freedom is 12, and this true, the chi-square for this one is not really bad, right? The p-value is probably not that bad, but this is what we have right now because we still don't have very good Lamm-alpha forest measurement, but hopefully in the future we can really tell that you really need to include this systematics to interpret any like a bispectrum from the Lamm-alpha forest. So you can also do other combinations. So we also try to consider the correlation of Lamm-alpha forest power spectrum and the underlying quasar over density.
So I guess what you're doing is that you're looking at the fluctuations in the forest and you're looking at, you correlate that with the lensing map.
Yeah.
And I guess you have to decide some distance scale between the lensing map and the line of sight. you didn't plot that, I guess that's enough.
So I'm sorry, I don't get your question. So you said
R per there.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So R perpendicular is just the angular position of the,
right.
Yeah, but if you're correlating this sine line and this, right, so if you're correlating this, yeah, and the same angular position, then you don't need to worry about this. But in principle, yes, you can also include this angular information of the sine line here and cross correlate with lensing on the other angular position. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we also explored that in the...
That depends on the resolution of your map, basically, right?
Yeah.
So the k on the x-axis is the radial wave number at which you repeated the power spectrum of the forest.
Yeah.
Okay, this is at a fixed separation, or...
Zero separation,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this is zero. Yeah, in principle, if you do like some separation, you can also plot this. Then you would need a contour plot. You would have like a one scale dependence on the right on the sine line of the forest and the like angular L between the angular position of this sine line and the lensing convergence. But this one they do like a same zero separation, so zero lag bispectrum. It's kind of like integral of the full bispectrum. Right, and you can also explore other like bispectrum. So in this paper, we explore trying to explore the quasar and Lyman alpha forest power spectrum. And the idea is to see whether we can even constrain FNL from this like model. And the reason is that we know quasar are highly biased, so the scale dependent bias signal there is larger. But it turns out that constraint is very bad because the noise of Lyman alpha forest measurement is very large. Right, it's completely dominated by the Lyman alpha forest noise. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. So if you want to do separate universe for this case, you need to consider different long modes because we know quasars are living in redshift space. So this is just the usual real space overdensity, and eta is the large scale velocity gradient because you have redshift space distortion, and phi is just the potential perturbation coming from FNL. So response of phi is really easy because in the extreme case, you're just changing sigma a. Yeah. Right, okay, so let me just conclude my talk here. So I hope I convince you that the separate universe simulation is a really powerful technique to study how small scales structure and the dependence of the small scale structure to the large scale density environment. And using this technique, we have find that the scale dependent bias. We have find scale dependent bias and scale dependent squeeze limit bispectrum. So remember, the scale dependence is for the long mode in the universe with massive neutrino. But there are still some some systematics we need to be worrying about. The first one is that in our box we don't simulate neutrino particle. Then you can always argue whether neutrino clustering is important or not. So to really convince people that we just need to go ahead and run big simulation with neutrino particle and see if we can detect the same effect. And another important thing is that when we run separate universe simulation, the assumption is always that the long mode has to be infinitely larger than the box size. Otherwise, you need to worry about the curvature of the mode. But in our separate universe simulation, in some case, we do have long mode closer. It's like a similar size as the box size. But our argument is that as long as the observable of interest that we're looking for example, the halo mass function, then you're looking just at some Lagrangian radius of the halo. As long as this scale of interest is much smaller than the long mode you're putting in, it's still pretty flat, so you still don't need to worry about the curvature. But we have some analytical argument, but it's still good to just convince people by running real neutrino particle simulation. So this is working in progress right now, and so hopefully we get some result very quickly. And finally, so I show you how separate universe approach can be used to even build different bispectrum models, squeeze bispectrum models for different observables. So in the future, if we're cross correlating everything with everything, then this might be a useful thing to think of. All right, thank you. Yes.
So you showed us that in the case of the neutrinos that you could model the response function for the halo bias
yep.
Using this collapse model.
Yep.
So if I use that and I did a calculation of the power spectrum in the Halo model, would I find consistency with the response function that you find in the power spectrum?
I'm not following. So you say you use the...
So a crucial ingredient is the Halo mass function.
Right.
The Halo bias.
Right.
And you know what the long mode does to those things.
Yep.
You've shown us that.
Yep.
So then if I use those ingredients in the Halo model and I calculate the nonlinear power spectrum...
I assume so, yeah.
Would it agree?
I assume so. I think so. We didn't do Halo model, but I forgot to point out there are lines here. So these solid lines with you can't even see the error bar because it's so precise from separate universe simulation. But you see the dashed line. The dashed line is coming from the one loop perturbation theory calculation in the separate universe. So I presumably you can also do Halo model for this case, and then you can also compute this. But we didn't do it. But I think they should agree because we did this in the lambda CDM case.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then, if that's the case, then what? Then you know, beyond showing that it is the case, like, does one need to run big simulations now, or can one just validate the correct? You know, if this picture is being correct from the simulations, and then henceforward. Do that.
Yeah, that's our hope, but
yeah.
We need to convince people first that this really makes sense.
Sure.
Yeah.
But then, so if I were to do that,
yeah.
you had 2 points and you were trying to extrapolate a straight line from those 2 points.
Yeah.
But then if you have this semi-analytic way of doing calculation,
mm-hmm.
I mean, does that agree with?
I never tried, but I think they should. Yeah. I never did that calculation. We only, for this kind of perturbation theory, for the power spectrum, I only do the standard perturbation theory. And it seems to work pretty well even to this case. So, yeah. And I think the extrapolation should be fine because if you think of this kind of effect as in terms of F nu, and F nu is already a small number, Taylor expanding this shouldn't be a real problem. But I mean, of course, it's good, also good if we can really have a, like a data points here. Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess this issue Matt mentioned about the Halo model, I'm a bit confused how Halo model can capture this thing. Because it seems to me Halo model, you just have to put it in by hand. Because I guess what you say is basically you have a larger scale mode,
mm-hmm.
and you want to see how it changes the power spectrum,
yeah.
But the Halo model, you just say the power spectrum is the correlation of halos. As long as you don't put any dependence on the larger scale mode, there won't be any.
Right, but I think I did this like long time ago, but I think in the presence of the long mode, then the halo would also be affected, right?
Halo model a priori doesn't know how it's affected, you have to. But basically, you have to use a simulation to model how it is. You cannot; it doesn't predict how.
You change the background.
Yeah.
Before you change the mass function of Halo.
That's what.
Before
yeah.
you change the Halo bias, and those are the ingredients. Right? You have to assume a background. So here, the whole thing changes the background.
But that the Halo bias. But then the 2-point function is that the same thing, or not? Because. 3-point function, I guess, is just a mass dependent. I guess if you just talk about a 3-point function, then you
build it up by calculating. I mean, basically, this would be a way of calculating this power spectrum response function, and then you build the 3-point function from the powers from how the power spectrum varies with the long mode.
Yeah, I think it's just Halo model is used with a linear power spectrum. Just the halos, the correlation of halos is just given by the linear power spectrum, which doesn't care.
That changes depending on the background, right?
But in principle, a priori you don't know how it goes. I mean, you have to model it somehow. I mean, the bias is one thing you can model, but the dependence of the power spectrum.
I can get back to you later. Yeah, after. Yeah, yeah. Yes.
So for these effects you mentioned, like the scale dependent bias,
yep.
you choose yourself, do you have some feature experiment in mind where you might be able to actually measure these?
Well, I think the scale dependent bias is always there. Right? If it's there, then it's always there. The problem is what kind of survey we can hope for to really detect this one. maybe you can use the cosmic variance cancellation technique. You have two different population of galaxies, and then they're tracing the same underlying matter, and maybe you can use the ratio of the bias to find it. But no, I don't have an exact number in my mind to tell you like what kind of survey that you need to worry about this. But for this, the cosmic variance cancellation technique, you really need high number density, I think, for both. Yeah, for both samples. So maybe we can hope for Euclid, LSST.
This is something you can forecast, right? You're able to.
Yeah. I think it's already done in Mari's paper. She has the cosmic variant, the sample variance cancellation technique. But I never tried to include this in the Fisher forecast for, let's say, halo power spectrum. Yeah. Because I don't think even current shot noise, current systematics, we can there's any hope to even detect this one. Yeah, because the effect you're looking at is, first, it's on very large scale. It's only 0.6 times f nu. In terms of power spectrum, it's 1.2 times f nu. But even like a small scale power spectrum we're looking at is like 1 minus 8 times f nu. Even that one is already a little bit hard to pin down. And on large scale, it's also, yeah.
All right, there are no more questions for the team. Let's take a look.
Right, thank you.